Quick inquiry, have you both signed in? Thank you very much. We're ready when you are. The case of Benjamin James Madonia versus the Commonwealth. Sure, you take your time. We're fine.
Greetings again, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
4 minutes, yes, sir.
So there are two assignments of error in this case. One is a chain of custody issue. This is a rape case on which my client was convicted and given a life sentence. On the chain issue, it's an abuse of discretion standard. And I know Your Honors know the facts of it, but I think just a quick recitation of the chronology of how this evidence got from A to B to C to D would probably be a good idea. So,
I'd appreciate it if you could address, are you making the suggestion that any time that someone in the chain is deceased, then the defendant gets a free pass?
Making the argument that it becomes significantly harder for the Commonwealth to prove a vital link when that vital link is deceased. And in this case, there was some evidence that was presented, and it was, in my opinion, hearsay. It was used...
Is it fair to say, though, that our case law makes clear that not everybody in the chain has to testify?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that, that not every person who handled evidence necessarily has to testify. I agree with that 100%, and I understand there's a lot of language out there in the various chain of custody cases that states that the Commonwealth essentially has to show reasonable certainty that the item that was tested hasn't been adulterated, tampered with, or substituted, or anything of that nature.
And can't we presume that the officer acted with regularity?
That's a good question, and I would say 100% absolutely not. That would be a...
What do our cases say about that?
There's a case about a public official, like a postal worker, and they would get the presumption of regularity. The problem with that is you could easily, if we just presume that officers do their job correctly, one, I think that would be at odds with our entire judicial system. We can't just presume that officers handle things properly. In that scenario, you could have a nurse do a swab, put it in an envelope, testify, gave it to an officer, have the judge believe that nurse, and then, you know, 10 days later it surfaces somewhere and we just assume that everyone in the middle was a police officer who did their job properly, because clearly Officer A wouldn't have done something irregular or wrong and perhaps gave it to Officer B, who's also a saint. So it becomes a problem when we start affording the same sort of presumption to police officers. A postal worker, I get, because a postal worker has no skin in the game. Police officers are investigating a crime, and they're clearly thinking that they have some valuable evidence, and they have to show every single vital link. So despite the fact that the Commonwealth will say there was reasonable certainty about the evidence, my position is you don't get to show reasonable certainty in a chain in which you're missing a vital link because the chain's broken.
So, well, there's no evidence that the item tested was adulterated or contaminated or anything like that, correct?
I would say that the defense didn't put on any evidence to specifically show that. So there, I would agree that...
Right, and there's an opportunity if you think that evidence is contaminated or that there's some specific problem with the analysis, there's an opportunity to cross-examine, bring in other witnesses or other evidence. I mean, that's the whole point of the cases, Blaine and Washington and all the rest of them.
Well, it does bring up an interesting point, because Officer Stacy, the deceased officer in this case, I mean, I'm not trying to be funny, but he might have been a horrible human being. He might have done his job. He might have been the most corrupt officer in the world. I wouldn't have any evidence on that. I don't get to cross-examine him. I don't get to, did you stop at Wendy's?
But then doesn't that take us back to the chief judge's initial question? So if an officer in the chain dies and you don't have an opportunity to say, aren't you a horrible human being, which I'm guessing would not have been your cross-examination.
Probably would not.
The evidence is no good, but that seems to fly in the face of our cases that saying that not everybody who touches a piece of evidence needs to testify or needs to be available to testify, because if any of them don't testify, you don't get to ask them, aren't you a a horrible person, or however you would try to establish that.
Well, I agree. I would just say that the record is completely silent on that chain. And then one of the major questions would be, is that a vital link? And I think it is. It's a police officer who's handling it for the purposes of establishing its value as evidence against ultimately my client. So in that scenario, I don't think this is with a postal worker. You hand it to the postal worker, they hand it to the person who probably puts it on a conveyor belt. I don't know what they do with it at the post office, but they do something to it. And yeah, we don't need everybody there because there's no eyebrow raise as to how the evidence was handled. But when it's the police department, they shouldn't get a presumption of regularity. I know the state lab does, but the police, if anybody shouldn't have one, it should be them.
Well, and this, doesn't the fact scenario here that this is a cold case hit years after and it's not, I mean, he couldn't have been trying to frame your client because they hadn't developed your client as a suspect.
I agree with that, but that doesn't mean that he handled it in a way that was proper. And this is at a time before DNA testing was even a major thing.
But you don't just assume that it's improper.
You can't. I completely.
So what in our record suggests that there was improper handling on the part of that individual?
There's nothing, I guess what I'm saying.
I mean, I know it's tricky, but in order to say it's a vital link,
it was handed, and this it was Detective Spry who takes it to Officer Stacey. Doesn't even take it to Officer Stacey. He takes it to property and evidence, or puts it in a refrigerator somewhere. And then their Commonwealth's basically proven the rest of the chain by saying, well, this officer who's not here, who we don't have any evidence about, other than perhaps a hearsay statement on the form, which was what I characterize it as, we can't tell you what happened there, we don't have him to present to the court for cross-examination to be asked questions. So my point would be there's two steps to the analysis. One, Commonwealth has to prove all the vital links. So was Officer Stacey a vital link? If he was, that should be it, in my opinion. But I do understand this Commonwealth has to prove with reasonable certainty. But they're proving with reasonable certainty all these other parts that aren't this missing vital link. So we have this massive gap, this giant hole in the chain, where this is a person who doesn't get a presumption of regularity. And for that reason, I think that the chain wasn't proven. I know that there's the, I think it's Hargrove case.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, if you're right, then Hargrove is wrong.
Well, Hargrove does, and I don't think Hargrove is not in line with what I'm saying. I think that there's two parts. You got to prove every vital link in the chain. If you haven't done that, I don't know what the word would be, stepped on the toes of whoever decided Hargrove.
The problem is, even if I were to agree with your basic argument, if it conflicts with Hargrove, I can't do anything about it. Hargrove's binding on me.
Yeah, and I don't think Hargrove is at odds with what I'm saying. I think it still says they have to prove every vital link. So the next logical question is it a vital link? Yes. Did they prove it? They couldn't have because they didn't have the vital link present. So that's the end of it. So despite the fact Commonwealth will say, well, it's mere speculation. You're just making up some pie-in-the-sky theory. I get that, but you didn't prove all the vital links, and Hargrove and all the case law says you got to prove every vital link. Doesn't say you got to prove everybody's role in the matter, but I think we narrow the issue. It just becomes, was Officer Stacey a vital link? I'd say definitely.
You characterize his signature as hearsay. Is that a business record?
That's a decent argument, I have thought of that. I don't think it's a business record by any stretch. I think it's the police who are clearly using it in anticipation of litigation. I don't think there's any other reason to make sure that we dot all the I's and cross the T's on this paperwork unless it's because some defense attorney is going to get up there and say, hey, you didn't prove the chain of custody. So,
how about we don't want to make a mistake?
Well, we don't want to make a mistake because we want to prosecute people with that evidence. So I would say it's the same six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Let me get you back to, I'm still having trouble with the notion that there's some sort of tampering or contamination or something that's problematic about this when the record seems to simply say, well, once it was taken out of where the first officer who died put it, everything else is fine. So where's why is this not under the Pope and all the line of cases? Why is this not just mere speculation that there's a problem?
Right. I guess I'm saying if I really was pursuing it I'm more so pursuing it on the admissibility period. The vital links weren't proven. So as far as the weight that it should be given, because Officer Stacy...
that's up to the trier of fact.
Right. So I don't think it should have been admissible in the first place, which was my objection on it. So I would rely on the rest of my brief, I guess.
Do you want to get to the other issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So there's a voir dire question. It's question 15.
Go for it.
It's a very straightforward question. You know, there's two reasonable explanations that can be drawn from the evidence. One's guilty, one's innocent. You got to find him not guilty. In a rape case, it's a very emotionally charged situation. You got these lay people who come in, act as jurors. And I'm trying to hammer home this point that just saying, hey, can you apply the reasonable beyond a reasonable doubt standard? That's not good enough. You need to ask these people, can you look at a guy, say, you probably raped this person. You probably committed a rape, and I'm going to let you walk out the door.
But analytically, they're the same thing.
I would disagree in the sense that under 8.01-358, you know, the defendant shall have the right to ascertain whether prospective jurors are willing and able to properly apply the law. So the law is the beyond reasonable doubt standard. But how are you going to ask them, can you apply the beyond reasonable doubt standard unless you give them the full implications of it, such as, can you let this guy that you're 80% sure did it walk out the door? Another thought experiment would be, you're at the dinner table that night, you're talking to your wife, you're talking to your daughter, or your child, or whoever, maybe your adult children, or whoever it may be, and you're saying, hey, you know, I really think this guy did it. I'm almost certain he did it, but they just had this one argument, so he's back out on the streets, and he might be walking down the street right now.
Under the instructions, whether given at voir dire or given at the conclusion of the case, and assuming, as we must, the jurors followed those instructions, is there anything about the instructions that were given that would prevent you from making the argument that, hey, even if you are 75% certain he did it, you'd have to acquit? I mean, the instructions covered that, and you could make that argument if you wanted to.
I don't think it covered it. I think we threw out the very generic beyond a reasonable doubt. Hey, can you follow beyond a reasonable doubt? Oh, sure.
Yeah, but
to be able to...
Once the beyond the reasonable doubt instruction is given, couldn't you make the exact argument that you're referencing here in voir dire? That, hey, you have a responsibility under the court's instructions to let him go even if you're 70% certain.
I think it's like you build a beautiful house. The voir dire is the foundation. It could be the most beautiful house on earth. That foundation is garbage. The house isn't going to stand up. So voir dire, we from the outset need to make sure we have the right people on the jury. By the time I'm doing a closing argument, they're not going to be like, oh, you know, by the way, I'm sorry, I can't apply.
I'm not asking you to disqualify yourself, but I'm asking, could you have made the argument that is essentially encompassed in your voir dire question, that even if you're sort of certain, you could make that argument in closing?
I didn't. I believe to some degree I did make that argument. I know I'm getting my rebuttal here, but I did make that argument to some degree. I threw out there in the closing, hey, here's a reasonable alternative hypothesis of what's going on. So you might have think they put on this person who didn't ID him, by the way, and that's one of the reasons why the vital link thing isn't harmless error. But, you know, I did put that alternative hypothesis that I argued was reasonable. So in that sense, I touched on it. I tried to patch it up the best I could. But the reality is my client was entitled to have 12 jurors who had to go through the process of answering questions, raising their hand, acknowledging it. You know what? If I think he did it, I'm going to find him guilty. And I think that's a very human question. And I think even people who know the law, lawyers, would probably sometimes struggle with that. You know, I think he did it. Can I let this guy walk? Rape's a horrible thing. This guy's accused of rape, you know, and I'm going to slam him. He just didn't have a fair trial from the outset is my position. So for that reason, the judge stated it's an incorrect statement of the law. So prong one would be, was it an incorrect statement of the law? I think it's perfectly correct. If there's a reasonable hypothesis consistent with innocence, no matter what other guilty hypotheses you have, you got to find him not guilty. And that's just the reality of it. To say it's an incorrect statement of the law, and also to contextually look at it with the other, there's another question I proposed that was along the same lines. I did tell him, this isn't a shoplifting case. You know, I want to ask, can you apply this beyond reasonable doubt standard in a rape case the same way as you could in a shoplifting case? Because that's, to me, a powerful question. It's probative. It's not useless by any stretch. And again, looking at that code section about voir dire, how can we ask jurors if they're willing and able to properly apply the law, such as the beyond reasonable doubt standard, if I can't tell them what that actually means, and if I can't ask them and flesh that out? And I don't think it was touched on at any point by the judge, despite the fact that we threw out some generic language of, yeah, beyond a reasonable doubt's a thing. These are lay people, these are lay veneermen. There's really no reason to think that they would have understood what they were getting into prior to 2 days later in the jury trial having to listen to me and the prosecutor. and then come to a decision on my client's future.
But you do understand that it's up to the trial judge under that code section to make the determination on the questions and the type of questions, and it's an abuse of discretion standard.
Yes, Your Honor, I do, but I think it was such a powerful question, and it was such a necessary question that it rose to the level of abuse of discretion. I've looked up the voir dire case law. It's usually not in our favor, but this one, in a case like rape, if this was a shoplifting case, I don't think I could make the same argument with a straight face, but if it's rape, child molestation, child pornography, something where people just get this icky feeling, and maybe they have some, you know, personal connection from a family member or their personal lives, this is something that's so emotionally charged that to not let me ask that question was an abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. With respect to the chain of custody issue, again, it is an abuse of discretion. I would point out, I think Judge Russell probably captured my argument. The crux of it really would be that if the defense is right in this case, Hargrove was wrongly decided, because that's another case where the Commonwealth did not provide testimony from the police officer who transported the forensic material to the lab. So I think it's almost an identical situation, and obviously under the doctrine of interpanel accord, you're certainly bound by it. It is a published opinion. You know, I would point out, too, page 577 of the appendix, we've certainly got Ms. Banty on the other end at the lab saying that the item was sealed when she got it. I would also point out, as I did on brief, the timeline here is very tight. Detective Spry, we know, again, from the record, and I've got citations for this in my brief, he put it in that locked refrigerator at 7 o'clock in the morning, and by 8:39, I believe, is the exact time Ms. Banty was receiving it at the Department of Forensic Science, a very, very small gap. I would point out, you know, there's a number of cases that were cited in either or both briefs. I think in Roe, which I believe was just cited in the defendant's brief, I think there was actually a 9-day gap between the time the officer who seized the material took it and took it to the lab, then took it to the lab after he had seized it. And we've obviously got some cases like Alvarez, which dealt with a quote-unquote gap with respect to when the forensic material was in the possession of an airline. And Robertson, of course, deals with mailing officials. I would like to answer one question. I did address this on brief, Judge Russell. You asked the question about police officers. The only case I could find where this court, and I think I probably looked in the Supreme Court too, had addressed that was the Wolf case, which was an unpublished opinion in 2016. And in that case, which of course you're not bound by, the court did apply that presumption with respect to a police officer, and I would certainly...
I know we have. I don't know that I'm terribly comfortable with it, but we have.
I understand the arguments against it, but I would point this out, though, Judge Russell. I think the end of that test says, absent evidence to the contrary or something to that effect, and I've got to say, you know, given the careful handling and the documentation we have, the very short timeline between the time we know it went into that refrigerator, because we did have testimony from Detective Spry that he put it in there at 7 o'clock, and it arrived at the lab at 8:39, I think that sort of buttons that up a little bit in terms of there not being some reason to believe that there's evidence to the contrary.
We don't even have to get into the presumption of regularity in this case, do we?
You don't. You've got a long body of law going back, certainly at least as far back as Reedy, and the Virginia Supreme Court has addressed this multiple times. You know, any sort of speculation, it generally goes to the weight. And here we've got a very tight timeline, as I said, I'm kind of reiterating myself at this point.
Well, but the timeline is significant for purposes of the, was there an opportunity for any kind of contamination or whatever?
Oh, absolutely.
And viewed in the context of this record.
And we know because Ms. Vanti, we're very lucky in this case because given the passage of time, it's amazing that we have the number of players able to come to court. I mean, Nurse Hoban, I think, is 87 years old when she testifies.
And you know, remembers this one.
I think is why appellant's counsel limited his, he very wisely limited his challenge to what happened in 1987.
Well, it's not germane to the specific issue before the court right now, but I would note that if I were on the other side and I had someone like that testify twice that she was a stickler for the rules, I probably would avoid that aspect of the chain myself. But kudos for the wise tactical decision on that part. But we do have Hargrove. I've addressed the hearsay about three different ways. I don't think this court has ever unpacked Rule 2:1101. I was curious because I've had that issue come up in other cases, probably on the habeas corpus side. Did we have a counterpart rule to Federal Rule of Evidence 104, which has been construed to say that you're not bound by strict evidentiary rules when you're making admissibility determinations? And friend, I always say friend, I guess it's Sinclair now, actually supports me on that. And there's a section in Sinclair that I cited on brief. And I suggest to you that's well established. You can rely on hearsay and other evidence that would otherwise be inadmissible in making admissibility determinations. And I think that's potentially important just in terms of whether the judge could properly consider this. I would note that a hearsay objection was made. It was overruled. I think you've got the full panoply in front of you as to why that would or wouldn't have been proper. I've obviously talked about business and public records. My response would have probably been similar to what Judge Russell said with respect to anticipation of litigation and these types of things. But and I've cited this in my brief too. McCormick has. I cited some case law that talks about McCormick talking about this. These types of things often come in as business records. Laboratory type records come in as business records. There are other courts, quite frankly, that treat that not as being for the truth of the matter asserted when all you're trying to do is establish a chain of custody, which I suspect maybe at least tacitly that comes back full circle to this idea that I articulated with respect to 2:1101. But there are courts that treat it that way, that chain evidence specifically being used to make an admissibility determination, that's not even truth of the matter asserted. And again, I'll go back to Sinclair again. There's a long line of cases, and I thought I found one from this court that was particularly significant when I was writing the brief, but I couldn't find it when I was looking yesterday. But we all know the polar extremes. Jane Doe told me John Smith shot that person. We know that's on one extreme, and that's truth of the matter asserted. And I guess the one that you most often hear is effect on the hearer. Your brakes are bad, or what did you do in response to that report you got, officer? I think we generally treat that as not being for the truth of the matter asserted. But I think, and again, I think Sinclair supports me on this, there are things that are between the extremes that are not quite as clear-cut. And there are certainly courts that have agreed with me on that point. Just briefly, with respect to the voir dire issue, clearly the basic law is you don't have a right to ask every question. I like the boilerplate that talks about not being able to have questions asked ad infinitum. And
is the question a correct statement of the law?
I can only speculate why the judge and the prosecutor thought that. Thought that it was not, because they didn't articulate why the dialogue starts. But as I said on brief, I don't think it's technically correct, because the case law says if it's equally susceptible to or near equipoise, and this proposed question was lacking that particular component of the test. So I don't think, as stated, it was correct. Now,
one of them's a one in a million shot, a fact finder can reject that one. If the reasonable hypothesis of innocence happens one out of a million times, the guilty hypothesis is true 990, the fact finder can reject the hypothesis of innocence, though arguably it's because it's not reasonable.
Correct. I think one example might be the tampering by the police officer. Is that possible? Well, we don't really know. We can't ask him. those types of things. I think you're absolutely right. And I guess it was in Haskins, this court talked about how you only come to that evidence, you only come to that standard once you sort of look at how the fact finder has resolved certain things. So I think it was lacking that pivotal language. I guess an obvious retort, and I'll go ahead and try to preempt it, an obvious retort is that if an instruction is vital, the court has some duty to clean it up. But this is not a jury instruction at the end of the case. And I'm not aware of any case that's actually said that you have to clean up something like that.
You certainly don't have to clean it up if there's other questions that cover it, right?
Right.
And that's my recollection, that the court also used as reasoning that this was cumulative. What was the line of questioning at voir dire that amounted to this same inquiry?
Well, I don't believe that the trial court ever actually got to the point where it talks about cumulative. I certainly made that argument on brief. Yeah. And the point is, and again, remember the purpose that this was proffered for. One was the jury needs it to be able to sort out what the standard is, but we know from Commonwealth versus Hudson and cases beyond that that the Virginia Supreme Court has said that this reasonable hypothesis of innocence essentially isn't a discrete end unto itself. I think that's language from this court, the discrete end piece. But it's just another way of saying that you've got to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it's two sides of the same coin. I would note, as I did on brief, because I think this is apropos of a question that Judge Russell asked, ultimately when instructed at the end of the case, the jury got both a reasonable doubt instruction and got the standard model jury instruction on circumstantial evidence. So would that completely cure an earlier problem if there were one? I don't know the answer to that, but you certainly don't need to reach that. And with respect to this notion that the emotions are high and so on and so forth because this is a rape case, the judge actually allowed a question on that particular point and essentially said, I don't think that people treat this the way they treat a run-of-the-mill crime. I think he kind of caught himself after he said that, said something to the effect of that may not have been my best choice of words. But so that particular issue was actually asked and inquired about of the jury, essentially, could you apply this standard in a rape case just like you could any other case? And he was allowed to ask that. So I think between those two instructions, at best the one that was requested and denied was redundant. And accordingly, and again, I think Judge Decker is the one who pointed this out, it is an abuse of discretion standard. It's a very high standard on appeal. And under those facts, quite frankly, I don't think that the defendant could even prevail if you were looking at this de novo, but certainly not under the abuse of discretion standard. Like Mr. Katz, I think I've talked for a while. If the court has any specific questions, I'll be happy to try to address those.
Hearing none? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and I'll submit on brief.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
I guess this thing about the hearsay objection was made in a pretrial hearing. I think the opposing counsel stated that the rules of evidence are permissible. Still at trial, I renewed all those objections for the exact same reason. It was stated multiple times. It's in the record, so I think that hearsay evidentiary rule should apply. Looking at the reasonableness on the voir dire question, it's the sort of the Judge Russell, the one out of a million. I think that would just preclude it from being reasonable if it's a one out of a million chance. I mean, I know the system's not perfect. I'd love one out of a million odds for finding people guilty when they didn't do it, but for that reason, I do think it was a correct statement of the law because it does preface by saying it's a reasonable. If it's a reasonable hypothesis, you got to find him innocent.
Let me ask you a question about that. Because you're saying that beyond a reasonable doubt is too hard of a standard. You have to make sure they actually understand what that means.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then are you entitled to ask questions to determine what they believe reasonable means? And at some point, isn't that why it's committed to the trial court's discretion or voir dire goes on for 6 years?
There is a spectrum, and I know other jurisdictions can do this stuff for like days or weeks. In Virginia Beach, we knock it out in an hour. But I will say that there is a point where it becomes, you know, that's too many questions, we've covered it. But for the judge to say it's an incorrect statement of the law, and then, you know, the counter argument to my argument is, well, he covered it in some other area of his questioning. I don't see it in the record, one. And two, how could he cover it if he thinks it's an incorrect statement of the law? So we're kind of at a point where you know, we have only the
record.
Well,
I guess it would be he covered the correct law to the extent that it would be an incorrect. Any part of it that would be incorrect was covered through the correct questions that were asked. In other words, denied it, right result, wrong, you know, got to the right result, wrong reason.
I would say it could only work in my favor that he said it was incorrect, the tone and the tenor of how the voir dire was conducted. It must have been with the judge having in mind that that's an incorrect statement of the law. So we look at the record, I don't see where that was cleaned up other than a very generic, beyond a reasonable doubt's a thing, but again, that statute, that's bootstrapping to me in that statute. That's the law. Okay, well, that the statute for voir dire says that I can make sure they can apply the law. How can I do that unless I can question them on the law itself, which is the beyond reasonable doubt standard? So we end up in this circular sort of argument with what's the point of that statute if they can just say, hey, the law's this, we're good.
Well, and we can't look at this in a vacuum either, because you've got the voir dire, you've got the jury instructions, and then you've got the closing arguments, and they all have to be looked at together, don't they?
I agree to some extent, except for the fact that I think the voir dire process, like I said, it's the foundation of everything. So we need to make sure that that is done as cleanly as possible, and we can't just presume that, you know, maybe these people went in with one mindset, but it got cleaned up because the attorneys did some great job or there was some instruction from the judge down the line. I didn't get to ask that person before they got on there, and that just, to me...
All right. We thank you, sir. The case is submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel, and that will conclude the